I'd also like to thank the organisers of tonight's event, Together for the Common Good, Lincoln Cathedral and the CCLA. Now, this lecture asks us to reflect on how common good theology can help us play our part in spiritual renewal. That is such a significant question. It is asking us to think deeply about the challenges we face as a nation, and we can all agree, I think, that these challenges are immense. I mean, you can simply name a few of them quite easily. The climate change, literally the future of the planet, populism, the hallmark of which is a friend-enemy distinction that breeds grievance, division, and conflict, questions of how we live together, specifically issues of race and migration, our relationship with outsiders, strangers, and the terms of modern citizenship, the insider-outsider distinction that challenges how we build or rebuild the social contract, and ideas of the commons, or any notion of the common good. We're consumed by fake news and the denial of truth, the rise of authoritarianism and political strongmen across the globe that challenge the fundamentals of a liberal democracy, the rule of law, independent elections, the civil exchange of ideas, how we reconcile difference and the like. Social media echo chambers, the rise of a hyper-individualized performative liberalism and identity politics, epochal technological change and automation, which challenge the very future of work, the lack of inclusive growth, escalating material deprivation and inequality, how we age and the future provision of health and social care, intergenerational challenges around housing, debt and work. These are all big ticket items. They cover the future of our public conversation and democracy, the future of the species and the planet, and the meaning and status of truth, how we care for one another, live together, and so much more. Yet, as an MP, my sense is there's almost an inverse relationship between the scale of the challenges we face and the capacity of politicians to offer remedies, let alone discuss some of this. The tension is getting worse. It's a disturbing state of affairs. And it begs the question, how we navigate the modern world and what resources are available to make sense of it all, to render intelligible these challenges and offer responses. That's why I say, Jenny, these series of talks are really important because of the questions they ask, questions that politicians dodge. We sort of literally hide from them. We stay in the weeds. We focus on trivia, political point storing. We pretend to be busy. We get through the day. And we stay away from the deep water. We sort of splash around in the shallow end of a lot of this stuff. And there's a lot of noise, but not much stuff that penetrates through and tries to diagnose what's going on. So I want to congratulate the organisers of these discussions who force us to confront some difficult and quite unfashionable terrain in terms of trying to analyse this stuff. Now, my talk is entitled Just Working, Why the Dignity of Work is at the Heart of Civic and Spiritual Renewal. And I want to try and focus on questions of human labour to address some of the wider issues I've mentioned. If you'd like to use the question of human labour as a portal into some of these challenging issues around the future of democracy and how we live together. Now, the obvious question is, why should we bother? Well, if we accept in a general sense the political instability that threatens the foundations of our liberal democracy, which I do, then we cannot assume democracy will survive. And if we acknowledge this, then to survive, it requires that we return to some fundamental philosophical questions, such as, how do we wish to live? What provides meaning in our lives? Where and to what do we belong? Now, historically, these questions have been answered and informed traditions of thought regarding competing visions of justice, theories about how society should be organised. And as happened before in periods of dramatic change, philosophers, politicians, those who contribute to the public square have sought to offer solutions And I think these questions of purpose have to be revisited, because I would suggest behind the backs of the authoritarianism that we see, the populism, the political rage, the disquiet, the anger, are forces that are driven, which lies a sort of fundamental point that is often obscured. And it seems to me there's this growing tension, escalating tension between the lives we live or we wish to live and the lives that we're forced to live. And that division finds expression in the rage and anger that we can detect in constituencies like mine, the anomie, the political alienation, and an accompanying lack of hope in the remedies offered by politicians. Not least because the same class of politicians that promised us very different lives, lives that are increasingly unavailable to many of our fellow citizens. So questions of purpose and meaning fuel this populist reaction, this sort of angry backlash against modern politicians and liberal democracy, which is failing to deliver the goods. And that is driven by frustration about the lack of purpose and meaning in our lives. Now, a French moralist once said, hope is the last thing that dies. And though it be exceedingly deceitful, yet it is of this good use to us, that while we are travelling through life, it conducts us in an easier and more pleasant way to our journey's end. The disappearance of hope bends towards despair. Just a few days ago, a shadow cabinet colleague of mine in the Labour Party said this publicly. He said, false hope is worse than no hope. And I sort of had a look at what he was trying to say there. And it is quite extraordinary. If we accept that hope is indeed the last thing that dies, his was an inadvertently revealing indictment of the present political state of affairs, almost one appealing to the virtue of hopelessness, which is a really, really interesting sort of statement about where we are politically in terms of the ability of the present political class to offer remedies. Now, why I'm interested in questions of human labour, because historically work and the struggles over human labour have offered meaning and purpose in our lives. They've been a source of human dignity and hope and have been central to the development of public philosophies to navigate the complexities of previous worlds, previous eras of epic industrial change and political struggle. So work is a good issue to address some of these larger questions. My simple point is, despair is not inevitable. History does not just unfold. We have to agency in political choices, irrespective of what politicians tell us. So tonight I want to cover a fair bit of ground. Firstly, I want to discuss why work and what used to be described in the 19th century as the labour question is back at the centre of our public conversation. I want to look at what Catholic social teaching might offer in this area. Third, I want to try and then use Catholic social teaching to develop a discussion of human dignity, then to sort of use that to confront issues of technological change and automation, and then to just throw in some policy ideas at the end. So here goes. Let's start with the labour question, which is very much back on the agenda. And I'll raise five reasons why I think it is moving political centre stage. Firstly, the effects of the pandemic, where work literally stopped. The furlough programme covering some 11 million people was an extraordinary political intervention. Our labour was politicised in ways that it hadn't been for decades. The tiny virus redefined the role of the state. A conservative government was forced to regulate who works where, under what conditions. And that is a big deal, not least because for decades we've been told that the state should keep out of something. The work-employment relationship was a private national transaction between consenting adults, employees and employers. In the context of the pandemic, the TUC emerged at the centre of our economic life for the first time in 40 years. The status and significance of human labour moved centre stage. The value attached to the work of others, specifically the vocations, the callings of public service workers, increased significantly. They had renewed value because they helped to keep us alive. Overnight, we almost reevaluated the jobs linked to the care of others, historically the worst remunerated jobs in the economy. Before the pandemic, much of this work was carried out by people, constituents of mine, who are often deemed part of the so-called left behind. I always think it would be better description to be seeing them as overlooked or ignored. During the pandemic, we clapped for our frontline workers. They became more visible, this work, and acquired a renewed standing. We recognised the dignity of their labour. The pandemic was an important moment. We confronted our own mortality and what we value in the lives, our own lives, and the contributions of others. It could have been a major turning point in terms of redefining what work is, how it's commodified, and the standing of different contributions within society. But I think we should be honest that the waters covered over and the moment passed. But that is the first reason why I think work has renewed significance. The second reason is because we're living through an extraordinary, unprecedented productivity crisis where productivity continues to underperform compared to other countries. Today, British output per hour and real wages are no higher than they were prior to the global financial crisis of 2008-09. Between 2008-09, 2008 and 2020, average productivity growth was just 0.4%. The UK ranks 31st out of 35 OECD countries in terms of growth of output per hour from 2008 to 2017. Before COVID-19 struck, our productivity growth was at its lowest since 2008. This wretched situation has led to literally 15 years of stagnating wages since the crash, a situation almost historically unprecedented. Yet despite this flatlining productivity, we have a political and a policy stasis. We literally don't know what to do about it. And the obvious question is to ask, why is there this stasis? Maybe it's something to do with unfinished business of the last 40 years in terms of our understanding of contemporary capitalism. The Bank of England describes our productivity problem as a puzzle, which is a really interesting word, a puzzle. It's a sort of benign, humorous word to describe something that in reality is a crisis in work quality and our productive capacity as a nation. So why can't we diagnose the crisis? I would argue because the whole of the political establishment assumed that under Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s, we witnessed literally a productivity miracle. And if you've had a miracle, then it's very difficult. You lose the language to diagnose a crisis that comes after. You can only resort to words like puzzle rather than analyze it for what it is. The third reason why work is increasingly important is because of the obvious point about the recent waves of strikes and militancy that we've been living through. After 15 years of flatlining productivity, stagnant wages, we've recently experienced an extraordinary inflationary surge triggered by global events, which have further dramatically contracted living standards. And people, quite rightly, in my view, have sought to challenge this as being unjust. Who can blame them? Well, actually, all the political parties can blame them who fail to offer support to them. And the fourth reason why labour is a focus of such attention, I've already mentioned, that's this question of automation, which I think is worth leaning into a bit. Before the pandemic, the future world of work was attracting widespread attention. It was regularly discussed in popular culture, modern literature, journalism, social, economic and political commentary. And two poles have emerged in this sort of debate. One signposts a sort of post-work nightmare of escalating inequality amongst a threatened humanity, subservient to technology. But the other, more popular view, suggests a future utopia of abundance, numerous routes to self-actualization, and even enhanced transhuman possibilities. This renewed interest in work futures reflects a widespread view that the robots are coming, often described as the fourth industrial revolution, one which will redraw how we live in ways that we can't even imagine today. And over the last month, you might have noticed this debate around AI has picked up again, and we're now revisiting these terms of debate: imminent technological upheaval, rupture, and the benign possibilities that this creates. We've had numerous tabloid headlines about displaced jobs through automation, technological upheaval, and the inevitable end of work. Yet, I would argue we've been here before. And it's instructive to learn from what has happened before. The depiction of alternative worlds through epochal technological change is a site where fiction and politics have regularly met. Throughout the early 20th century, science fiction followed or allowed politics to reassert the need for human solidarity and political agency to contest the malign consequences of our intellectual development. Sci-fi retained an ethical humanist tendency. Left unchallenged, technological change could usher in tyranny. The human imperative to ensure that this was not left unchallenged. Some view the texts as dystopian. I view sort of Huxley's Brave New World, Orwell's 1984, as political interventions, warning shots to choke off dystopian trends in modern society. Huxley's target was a sort of dominant left utilitarianism. Orwell's was a sort of totalitarian scientific. In contrast to these humanist and democratic warnings regarding technological change, the tendency today is to see technology as destiny, to leave unchallenged these forces of production. For instance, the political embrace of automation and the interest in the idea of a universal basic income, a brilliant idea, but some of the drivers for the renewed fashionable interest on it about sort of deterministic views about technological futures. Today, few ethical questions are asked about technological change. We tend to shrink the conversation down to utilitarian concerns about what is best for Britain PLC. Rather than some of the deeper questions. So overall, there's these five basic reasons why the labour question is back in the news, and so too is the working class. In a period of profound change, we've seen the reconfiguration of political coalitions. On the right, the success of the Conservative Party in the so-called Red Wall and the growth in support for Tories amongst the working classes post-Brexit. Now, they're obviously looking to cement that coalition, not necessarily successfully at the moment, but they are. On the left, we witnessed a still unresolved crisis in the future of social democracy. What's it for? Who it represents? What's its organising philosophy? And we've seen the emergence of new socialist imaginations, often described as post-workerist, a world of post-capitalism, luxury communism, the imminent end of work. This assumes that the working class is on the wrong side of history, given the march of the machines, a view shared both by elements in the Blair agenda around Labour and the Corbyn agenda around Labour over the last 20 years. We're seeing the rebirth of technological determinism, and any cursory reading of history, especially on the left, will be worried about the growth of technological determinism in terms of the denial of agency and democracy that goes along with it. A new political coalition is suggested by many progressives. Thomas Piketty describes it as the Brahmin left, that the future left coalition is around the urban, educated and networked. Little room for traditional approaches to work and labour. And I would argue many working class people know this, they feel it, and they acknowledge the disdain that they have felt by many that historically have been associated with the representation of the working class in this country. Seems to me this is all symptomatic of how the political parties that encase the variants of 20th century liberalism, socialism and conservatism are scrambling to make sense of the modern world. As Jenny said in the introduction, traditional political allegiances are crumbling and the political philosophies themselves are hollowing out. Recognising the challenge this poses to liberal democracy, some of our greatest philosophers, such as Michael Sandel, who was mentioned earlier, have argued that this necessitates a new politics of work, one that requires a new approach to inclusive growth, including confronting the just rewards afforded to work in our society, a rethink around the hubristic approach to meritocracy and knowledge work, and the need to reevaluate the work of others, and actually decommodify the terms of our debate around work to include other forms of activity and voluntary work. And how it's gendered as well. And we need to debate the future of work and the implications of it and challenge whether these are inevitable certainties or political choices. And finally, we need to rebuild the politics of work within national bordered communities and to allow us to reconcile and beyond and move beyond the sort of binaries that currently dominate politics around age, education, geography, class, Brexit. And they disfigure our national conversations. So we can conclude that the politics of work, following decades where it was decoupled from politics, is back on the agenda. And therefore, it's a timely moment to rehabilitate traditions of thinking about labour and work. And one of these is Catholic social teaching, which has been mentioned. On May 15, 1891, Pope Leo XIII published Rerum Novarum in Latin of revolutionary change on the rights and duties of capital and labour. What I found most intriguing about it was written nearly a decade before the creation of the Labour Party. A point I'll return to in a minute. In it, the Pope sought to preserve the essential dignity of workers at a time of rapid social change and the unbridled growth of the power of capital, which sounds pretty familiar to me. Rerum Novarum remains an extraordinary condemnation of unfettered industrialization and the immiseration of the working classes. It has a contemporary feel in a world that sort of envisions 21st century technologies, often coupled with 19th century employment conditions in sectors stretching way beyond the so-called gig economy. The 1891 encyclical asserts the moral imperative to regulate capitalism, and it planted a preferential option for the poor into the evolution of Catholic social thought. This creed advocated unions, collective bargaining, a living wage to maintain and preserve the dignity of the person in the workplace. It urged the capitalists, and I quote, not to look upon their working people as their bondsmen, but to respect in every man his dignity as a person ennobled of Christian character. Its focus was morality and not just questions of utility. Again, something that modern politicians might wish to dwell on. And briefly, to return to the question of the intervention by Pope Leo, occurring nearly a decade before the creation of the Labour Party, it's useful to consider the sort of religious character of socialist thought in the period of the encyclical, beyond just Catholic social teaching, actually. The notion of the religion of socialism captures a distinct approach to socialist justice that informed much of the prehistory of the Labour Party. Influences included not just Catholic teaching, but dissident, nonconformist Protestant voices of Methodists, Baptists, Congregationalists, Quakers, Unitarians. Assorted churches included the Brotherhood Church, the Labour Church, later renamed the Socialist Church, the Ethical Church, as well as the Salvation Army, the Temperance Church, groups such as the Fellowship of the New Life, alongside visions of socialist fellowship and the moral economy associated with writers such as John Ruskin, William Morris. Such thinking was revealed in journals such as the Socialist League's Commonweal and the Clarion newspaper, which started in December 1891, 6 months after the Pope's encyclical. It was expressed in the poetry of Edward Carpenter and William Morris, including the latter's The Pilgrims of Hope in 1886, in books, religions, pamphlets with titles such as Blandford, The New Religion, or Bruce Glacier, the pioneer of the early ILP, The Religion of Socialism, in J.L. Joyn's Socialist Catechism, published weekly in 1884. It was a language of religiosity that infused the socialism of the period. Political conversions themselves were often quasi-religious experiences. Socialism, for many, was an evangelical-like force, one demanding both sacrifice and missionary activity in pursuit of making socialists. At this stage, laborism had not found a particular voice or institutional home. Socialism had yet to discover the utilitarian language of later social engineers or be captured by the machinery of state welfareism. In short, the politics of labour had yet to be assigned a political bureaucracy. The first principle of the Labour Church said that the labour movement is a religious movement. Such sentiment was shared by many across a variety of traditions in the 1880s, 1890s. Its leading advocates sought to challenge the scientific status of economics and the separation of economic value and utility from questions of human life, and deterministic assumptions regarding modernity and the evolution of socialist society found within much socialist economic thought, the technological determinism, which is such a regular drumbeat within the history of the left. In the critical last decades of the 19th century, the religion of socialism was for many a way of life, and often their work took the form of a crusade. If you read this historian, Stephen Yeo, he's explained the way such advocacy often involved forms of conversion, with socialism akin to religious vocations, callings, with activists often termed apostles or evangelists for the cause. It's no coincidence that Keir Hardie, George Lansbury, Ramsay MacDonald were often described as the apostles of the old religion in their roles in the early formation of the Labour Party. Such feelings were intimately related to the brutality of late 19th century capitalism, with socialist resistance essential to human salvation, and were themselves embedded within ancient traditions of thought regarding the promotion of the common good and human virtue. Yet such ethical sentiments were later diluted when consolidated into the formal party structures and the calculus of electoral politics. This sort of process helps account for the exile of ethical traditions within the history of the Labour movement. The religion of socialism sought to promote a life of virtue, to act with wisdom, compassion, and cultivate an essential humanity in combating industrial capitalism, primarily around the dignity of labour itself. It represents a politics of resistance, of the commodification of life, our families, our relationships, a continuous struggle, not just against the alienating effects of capitalism, but also left-wing utilitarianism and Fabianism in the contest to shape a just society. In the cauldron of the 1880s and 1890s, it was a politics in search of an authentic human life, to ask the questions of purpose that I mentioned earlier. Socialism was understood as a calling to contest human degradation and retain dignity. But the page turned, time passed, and the religion of socialism was overtaken by electoral realism and institutional consolidation. Now, my simple question is, why not retrieve a bit of the old religion regarding questions of human labour? This is not just a history lesson, actually. 90 years after Rerum Novarum and its encyclical Laborum Exercens on human work, Pope John Paul offered his restatement of this very tradition. It begins by elaborating why work is not simply a commodity or random action, but is essential to human nature, a fundamental dimension of human existence on earth, it says. Because as the image of God, he is a person, a subject, being capable of acting in a planned and rational way. Man is therefore the subject of work. And by acting on nature through work, he finds fulfillment and becomes more of a human being. Laborum Exercens reasserts, and I quote, a principle that has always been taught by the church, the principle of the priority of labor over capital. It follows that protections must be in place to halt violations of dignity, including unemployment, wage inequalities, job insecurities, and technological change. This last element can supplant the person. I quote, taking away all personal satisfaction and the incentive to creativity and responsibility, where it deprives many workers of their employment, or when through exalting the machine, it reduces man to the status of its slave. Work is a spiritual activity, following literally in the footsteps of a carpenter, through which the worker collaborates with the creator for the redemption of humanity. Quote. Today, Pope Francis follows, is a radical advocate of this intellectual inheritance. We do not get dignity from power or money or culture. We get dignity from work, he said in 2013. Work is fundamental to the dignity of the person. Work, to use an image, anoints with dignity, fills us with dignity, makes us similar to God, who has worked and still works, who always acts. So a recurring drumbeat in Catholic thought is that recognition of dignity in others as a means of recognising it in ourselves, and is a way of understanding the capitalist employment relationship and the rights and duties of the employer and the worker. A belief in the dignity of the person is moulded into our understanding of how under certain social relations our common humanity can be violated and how work can perform or degrade this abstract sentiment. Just want to drill in then into this question of human dignity. Until recently, the dignity of labour appeared as a somewhat old-fashioned, dated term. Until recently, if we detest human dignity, we were more likely to contemplate how we die rather than how we live. The pandemic changed that. As I said, in confronting death as individuals, as families, as communities, as society, we once again recognise the worth of others and realise the dignity of their contributions. We applauded care home workers, nurses, porters, orderlies, doctors. We were moved by the sacrifice of tube, bus, lorry drivers, the selflessness of cleaners, teachers, police officers, and men and women in emergency services, frontline council workers, welfare, housing officers, maintenance, refuse operatives, as well as delivery drivers, supermarket employees, many, many others. This work was briefly more visible and acquired renewed standing. Questions of dignity and the dignity of labour could therefore become some form of organising principle for a new politics built around a revived sense of justice. Over recent years, arguably, my own party, the Labour Party, has lacked, let's say, a noticeable conception of the good life, let's call it that, a telos, a purpose. Ethical concerns have lost out to technocratic and purely economic ones. In truth, a recurring theme throughout Labour history, the exile of the ethical tradition. More worrying still, as I mentioned earlier, is the emergence and popularity on the left of this tech utopianism, even transhumanism powered by AI and automation. Such ideas, I would suggest, leave us stranded in the 21st century with modern technology, 19th century employment conditions. But just to push this point a bit, what do we mean by dignity? Because the word retains a moral purchase but remains controversial. In a widely cited editorial in the BMJ in 2003, the American bioethicist Ruth Macklin declared that dignity is a useless concept in medical ethics and can be eliminated without any loss of content. In 2008, the psychologist Steven Pinker published an article in the New Republic entitled The Stupidity of Dignity. Now, it seems to me we can identify a thin version of dignity which originates from Latin notions of worthiness to describe a concrete achievement in terms of respect or status. But dignity is not just about status or standing. The worth of a worker cannot simply be measured by his or her salary or position in an office hierarchy. The word also suggests something more significant, something that must, which can be ambiguous and elusive, but which can be readily recognised when it's lost. It suggests ethical duties in how we order society, for instance, in tolerating slavery, abuse, exploitation, or allowing some forms of imprisonment. We compromise both our personal and our collective dignity. The idea of a negation of human dignity implies a process of reduction, degradation, dehumanization. It captures some intrinsic human worth with minimal acceptable moral standards that we can recognize, whether you come from a religious or a secular humanist standpoint, actually. I think the loss of personal dignity actually underscores the rage and anger that drives populism and underscores modern politics. The distinction between the lives we want to live and the lives we're increasingly forced to live. And that growing gap, that canyon between those two, creates a sense of enemy that drives the rage that we witness all around us. Understood in these terms, dignity has real political significance and purchase, and it can be detected across group of spiritual, ethical, and human rights traditions. In secular traditions, human dignity relates to notions of agency or autonomy and the ability of humans to choose their own actions. In both traditions, dignity can embrace a shared state of being that involves obligations, not just in religious traditions, but also secularized traditions. It sort of implies the ethical duty to remedy things or processes that violate the dignity, genocide, torture, tyranny, exploitation, and the like. Our dignity, both in a personal as well as a collective sense, is shaped by what we tolerate and what we do not. And it's an organizing method for how we build a conception of justice, a view of how society should be organized. That seems to me to have real power. It was actually famously captured in Articles 1 and 2 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, created in the aftermath of a generation facing up to tyranny and authoritarianism, genocide, and adopted by the UN Assembly in 1948, literally 75 years ago this month. Article 1 states, as well, quoting it, "All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. Article 2, everyone is entitled to all the rights and freedoms set forth in this declaration without distinction of any kind, such as race, color, sex, language, religion, political or any other opinion, national or social origin, property, birth or status." The point being, Article 2 follows Article 1, not through a natural rights vision of human rights, but born through the need to ethically confront the drivers of genocide, tyranny and authoritarianism. That is the organizing principle to reimagine a post-war world 75 years ago. So what does that sort of mean for questions of technological change, automation and IR? Well, my argument is quite simple. We take a step back and focus on fundamental ethical questions that this period of epoch or technological change throws up, rather than jumping into the technical policy issues and solutions. Yet, the problem is, as mentioned earlier, utilitarian thinking dominates politics. Political philosophy can be divided into sort of three traditions regarding competing visions of justice. One that seeks to maximize human welfare. Second, that seeks to maximize human freedom. And third, maximizing human virtue. The first tends to focus on questions of utility, mostly economic utility. The second, the question of liberty and rights. On the political right, we see libertarianism. On the left, recourse to economic and social rights to remedy disadvantage. And the third is more ethical and indeed more judgmental, concerned with the question of human flourishing and nurturing the common good. But traditionally, this third tradition, the area where faith and politics mix, remains increasingly unfashionable and exiled from much of our political conversation. Politics is prone to utilitarian thought, obviously to maximize the welfare of the maximum amount of people, the terrain of welfare economics, if you want. It's got a natural fit with a lot of reasons why people go into politics. Totally understandable. The danger, for example, around technological change is it tends to focus in on the aggregate benefits to Britain PLC, rather than, for example, the questions of the constraints on questions of human flourishing, especially when those new technologies have the power to challenge the integrity of the human condition itself. For me, this should be the political entry point, the defense of the human condition. Why is it not? Politics long ago lost its ethical grip and has been sort of residualized into variations of technocratic administration driven by prioritizing questions of utility. Populist uprisings can therefore be seen as an angry verdict, a backlash against that methodology that dominates politics, especially when the lives we wish to live compared to those we have to live are increasingly at odds with each other. There are no remedies in terms of a sense of justice animated by the political conversation in that world. This suggests the need for a very different public conversation, one that addresses moral and cultural issues regarding the lives people wish to live and why they cannot. So it's important to me that we embed our conversation of technological change, robotics and AI within this deeper conversation. Artificial intelligence obviously has the potential to affect all policy areas, yet current thinking around AI is reactive and simply geared towards ensuring Britain is at the forefront of this technological progress. So maybe we should just take a step back, begin to by discussing what role technology should and should not play in our societies, our workplaces and our personal lives and the society we might wish to live in, with echoes of the late 19th century in terms of the religion of politics in that period. But there is a further challenge today for politicians and policymakers with regards to AI, owing to their lack of technological and scientific expertise in these areas. And I put my hand up as one of them. So we rely on technologists to give an account of what their software can do or might lead to, which is especially problematic, obviously. Many politicians have bought into this sort of techno-solutionism, the idea that all problems which humanity face can be solved using technology, including those problems that technology itself creates. For many in Silicon Valley, we see this libertarianism as the role of technology, and hence their profit margins expands, so should the role of the state, they believe, truncate. Then there are those who I've mentioned come from a transhuman background. Madden transhumanism asserts that technological change creates the opportunities to transcend the human condition of becoming transhuman, and this has to be celebrated. Resistance is deemed nostalgic, parochial. This is applicable both to libertarian politicians on the right, but also, as I mentioned, those on the radical left. Consequently, philosophers like Jürgen Habermas, for example, who argue that we should defend a species ethic in the public conversation when we navigate this terrain, are dismissed as I say, parochial contributors. These are deep waters and should be dominating political discussion, but they're virtually non-existent. You never hear any of this in Westminster. But technology is not destiny. There are political choices. Yet technological determinism has dominated politics since the start of the Industrial Revolution on both the left and the right, and the dangers are numerous. You can recall a variety of them, from data analytics used by in targeted political campaigns at the expense of our democratic process, facial recognition software now being trialed for the purposes of marketing by judging facial expressions, filter bubble effects on civic and our social lives, building echo chambers, segmenting communities at the expense of any transcendent public conversation, any idea of the commons or the common good. The ramifications of all this could be catastrophic. Public debate will suffer from the ease by which fake news will be produced on an epic scale. Our very knowledge of the world around us and notions of truth will be further compromised. Posing the greatest threat could come from the feelings of powerlessness and exclusion felt by many as they realise decisions about them, from hiring, policing, insurance, whatever, are made by machines. I'm stretching the sort of boundaries of my lecture a bit. These issues all, though, covered in the range of these England lecture series. But my basic argument is that we really need to return to first principles, asking questions about the value we place on work, freedom, privacy, community and justice, in short, the type of society we want to live in. From there, we can discern the role we wish to allocate to technology rather than being seduced by the type of novelty and the processing power of technology. If we do not build policy upon well-defined visions of human flourishing, policymakers will put technological and economic progress above people. Or we may endorse a sort of soft technological determinism using policy only to manage what we euphemistically call risk. What is really at stake are huge social issues, rising inequality, the accumulation of power in the hands of private companies and human dignity. So policy needs to become more than a technocratic exercise in risk management. Our political conversation needs to change, return to deeper questions of what constitutes a good life and a good society. And I simply say that we could begin that reformation, if you by re-establishing the dignity of labour. Now, policy ideas are numerous. You could begin with the promotion of good work as an act of public policy. A good work charter the state could embrace might include the right of everyone to have access to good work with fair reward, decent conditions, that is a source of equality, dignity, autonomy, one that promotes human well-being, has a right to representation, participation, access to lifelong learning, maybe like other institutions that have been created in other areas of public policy, we could have a What Works Centre for good work, how you nurture that, the role of best practice. We could renew vocation, go back to the Thomson Review of the equality between academic and vocational training, new National College of Skilled Work and the Professions. In terms of voice of work, you could reform the Companies Act, confront the question of directors' duties, industrial democracy, rights to voice, co-determination that's been test-rided across other Western market economies. We could drill into questions of economic democracy, worker ownership, new forms of sectoral union organisation. We could revive the old fair wages resolution to spread collectively determined conditions into unorganised sectors. We could have a new Bill of Rights around preserving personal dignity at work to push back against some of this sort of ammonisation of work, defend the integrity of the person against excessive surveillance in the workplace and over homeworking, regulation of the role of technologies, review the category of worker in law in terms of who's a worker, who's an employee, who's a contractor, specifically regarding the gig economy, new rights for public service workers, priority access to housing, transport, whatever we want to choose, new rights at work in terms of a genuine living wage, jobs that you can raise your family on, the origins of which were our early discussions in East London decades ago about what constitutes a living wage rather than a minimum wage, family-friendly policies, right to time off, sick pay, holiday, go through all of that, new infrastructure investment in care sectors, education, environmentally sustaining work, upholding voluntary work, trying to contest the commodification of work. Biden's rescue plan around his jobs plan, family plan, are instructive in some of this. You could go back to FDR's 1944 Bill of Rights, second Bill of Rights, which never was enacted in law, about new rights to work alongside new rights to housing, access to socialized medicine. You could go through these sort of things. You could put work at the center of government policy. You could create a new department for work, new employment standards in all forms of public procurement, supply chain compliance and the like. You could have new integrated enforcement procedures to uphold minimal standards and a floor underneath the economy. You could create a new council on work futures linked to environmental challenges, but also the ethical challenges of new technology as part of a renewed public conversation around the purpose of human labour in our economy and the constraints on technological change. This is all possible. It could be a jumping off point to a wider discussion of meaning and purpose, of renewed citizenship and democratic renewal, but it requires political will and the realisation of the need for a public conversation that is qualitatively different than that presides around Westminster now, one informed by ethics and not just utility. And I'll simply conclude by saying the present resembles the past. In 1894, the great artist and illustrator Walter Crane, in a magazine called Justice, The Origins and the Organ of Social Democracy, depicted the workers' maypole, and with the words across it that said, "The cause of labour is the hope of the world." It seems to me it was as true then as it is today. So thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak to you all on this evening. Thank you very much, Lynn.